This audio file is a production of Chiasmos, the University of Chicago's International and Area Studies Multimedia Outreach Source. For related audio and video, or for more information about the project, please visit chiasmos.uchicago.edu or internationalstudies.uchicago.edu.
I'm Susan Zesch, Director of the Human Rights Program, and I'm quite pleased to welcome all of you here to the newly air-conditioned International House Assembly Hall. It's only since May 1st that they've had air conditioning in here, and we are the lucky beneficiaries of some donors' generosity, I'm sure, but I'm not sure who. I want to welcome you to an event which is a double event, and very rightly so. Last year was the first Robert Kirshner Memorial Lecture here at the University of Chicago. And Bob Kirshner, whose biography you can read, it's a partial biography in the inside of the program, because Bob did so many things that we didn't have space for. Bob's vision of how the theory and practice of human rights needed to be taught together, and how working in human rights could inspire students, not just as practitioners, but as global citizens, people who cared about what states did to people, people who cared about the fundamental dignity of human beings. That he had a vision, along with other faculty, Jeffrey Stone, who's in the provost of the university, Jacqueline Baba, now at Harvard, Rashid Khalidi, now at Columbia, the late Alan Gewirth, the philosopher, the late Martha Nussbaum, our surviving board members who are still here, Michael Geyer from history, Jim Chandler from English, Manuela de Cunha from anthropology, Marvin Mackinnon from biology. This group of faculty got together to develop a project that would place human rights squarely in the midst of a liberal arts education. This is our 10th anniversary, and there are many people we could thank. And so, since this is not the Oscars, we decided to put the thank yous in the program. We want to thank the entities of the university who have supported us, the individual donors who have supported the program in general, and particularly the interns. And we want to thank our staff, and we want to thank the foundations who have also contributed to our activities. The Human Rights Program consists of three parts: scholarship, which is curriculum, research, and workshops; public events like this; and the internship program. The internship program provides paid internships to, this year, 35 University of Chicago students who will spend 10 to 12 weeks this summer working at a wide range of projects, from grassroots human rights organizations to United Nations entities. They work on issues from rehabilitation of child soldiers, to police misconduct, to the marginalization of people with HIV and AIDS, to housing rights. There are a number of our intern alums who are here for alumni reunion weekend. We're going to have a total of about 40 of them here for the weekend, thanks to the generosity of Dr. Richard Posen and Ann Silver Posen, who have helped subsidize their plane fares. And I'd like everyone here who's a U of C student who is in the human rights program and the alums to just all raise your hands so people can see who you are. And so if you have questions about these terrific young people and our program, now you know who to talk to. We will have reception after the program in the back, and Alex Kotlowitz will be signing books out in the table at the hall. It is my great pleasure to introduce last year's Robert Kirshner Human Rights Lecturer, Sarah Paretsky. Sarah, we picked Sarah last year because she was very close to Bob and consulted with him, and she had a wonderful story about how they met when she needed an expert who could tell her whether it was indeed possible to kill someone by hitting them over the head with a trumpet. And since Bob was both a forensic pathologist and lover of music, he was the perfect person for Sarah to talk about this important issue with. When Sarah Paretsky introduced her detective V.I. Warshawski in Indemnity Only in 1982, she revolutionized the mystery world. By creating a female investigator who uses her wits as well as her fists, Paretsky challenged a genre in which women typically were either vamps or victims. She's written two novels outside the V.I. Warshawski series. She details her personal history as well as the history of her writing in Writing in an Age of Silence, which came out last year in 2007, and it was nominated for a 2008 National Book Critics Circle Award. Not only has her own work broken barriers, but she has also helped open doors for other women. Her creation of Sisters in Crime, which supports women writers, earned her Ms. Magazine's 1987 Woman of the Year Award. In 2002, the British Crime Writers awarded her the Cartier Diamond Dagger. I'd like to see that sometime. To give back to the community, Sarah Paretsky established the Sarah and Two Sea Dogs Foundation, which supports girls and women in the arts, letters, and sciences. She's endowed scholarships at the University of Kansas and has mentored students in Chicago's inner city schools. She serves on the advisory board of Literature for All of Us, a literacy group for teen moms, and she works closely with Planned Parenthood. Sarah is here to introduce our speaker for this year's Robert Kirshner Memorial Lecture, Alex Kotlowitz. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be here and to see this room filled to capacity. And not only that, not just with us doddering old Hyde Parkers, but with all these energetic young people. That really is a great thing to see. I think everyone in this room knows the magnitude of Bob Kirshner's work, his creation of the program in forensic pathology for Physicians for Human Rights, his unflinching testimony about torture committed in police precincts here in Chicago, his work in setting up protocols on torture, his keen mind, his passion for justice, his leavening humor made him unique in the human rights world, as in the lives of his friends and family. He is irreplaceable. There is no one fitter to speak in Bob's memory than Alex Kotlowitz. In his journalism and his books, Alex has embraced the world of the marginalized and dispossessed with the same courage and openness that Bob did. Alex comes from a family of quiet heroes, and he married into another such family, people willing to confront serious injustice with the courage not to flinch when their principles bring them face to face with danger. I first encountered Alex through the Wall Street Journal, where he wrote the articles that became "There Are No Children Here." His willingness to join in the lives of the Rivers family, to stand with them in sorrow, in trouble, in danger, to stay with them long past the end of his professional involvement in their lives, exemplifies Bob Kirshner's spirit to a remarkable degree. Although Alex's next book about Benton Harbor, the other side of the river, isn't perhaps as well known, it is as rich and true and just as There Are No Children Here. And no journalist since Royko has so thoroughly dug himself into the lives of Chicagoans and their neighborhoods as Alex, as he shows in his loving memoir to the city, Never a City So Real. Alex is a transplanted New Yorker who has found his true home in Chicago. Like other second city chauvinists, I'm pleased to know that he made the journey to the other side of the river, the Hudson in this case, and found us to his liking. It is a pleasure and an honor to welcome him tonight.
Well, thanks. Well, it's what an honor it is to be here tonight. Sarah, thanks for that lovely introduction. I first met Bob Kirshner through a mutual friend of ours, John Conroy, and that was some 15 years ago. And what always amazed me about Bob is that given his line of work, one would think he carried a heavy load. One imagined a man with his shoulders stooped, his eyes deep set, his voice a murmur. I expected a character out of a Dostoevsky novel, but of course Bob was anything but that. You know, Bob walked gently, and he had such a generous spirit. And though solemn at times, who wouldn't be given his what he had seen, he was easy to laugh at the world and at himself. He walked lightly. I had originally gone to Bob for guidance. I was in the midst of my second book, the one Sarah mentioned, The Other Side of the River, and I was trying to fathom what had happened to a 16-year-old African-American boy whose body had been found in the St. Joseph River, which, like barbed wire, separates the predominantly black Benton Harbor from the predominantly white St. Joseph. And I had gone to Bob with all the pathology exams and photos and police reports, which Bob was gracious enough to read and then sit down with me to try to make sense of what the body told us. It's what Bob did and did so well. He tried to piece together the stories of the dead and the victimized, whether it was a young man tortured in a Chicago police station, or a young woman disappeared by the Argentine military, or this young boy whose death is still a mystery. John Conroy told me the story once of when Bob was asked to testify in the case of Andrew Wilson, who claimed he'd been tortured by a Chicago police detective, John Burge. Bob agreed to look at photos that had been taken of Wilson, and with a magnifying glass, he determined there were marks on Wilson's ears, which could have only been made by roach clips. Well, in court, the prosecution had blown up these photos so that they were poster size, and they made the case that the inmates in the county jail had roach clips on them, often as contraband, and so that it was likely, they argued, that Wilson had clipped them to his ears to make this false claim. And they asked Bob to take a look at these poster-sized photos in the courtroom. And Bob got up close, and he was able to make out what he couldn't make out with his just his magnifying glass. There were burn marks surrounding the impressions made by the roach clips. And in that courtroom, Bob asked, how could there be burn marks other than from the electrical current, which Wilson had alleged had been pumped through him through the roach clips? Bob made sense of precisely what the prosecution was trying to obfuscate. Andrew Wilson had indeed been tortured, as we well know, as had many others. Bob, better than anyone I knew, instinctually understood that narrative is how we make sense of the past, how we manage the present, and how we secure the future. And so we set forth into the world trying to piece together the narratives of the forgotten, those whose stories would otherwise disappear into the ether of inhumanity, those whose stories would be rewritten by those in positions of authority, those whose stories he knew were essential to finding our way as a society with dignity, with decency, and with honor. And this is what I want to talk about with you this evening, is how story, how understanding from whence we came, how we got where we are, is essential to our eternal struggle for the maintenance of human rights. Our own Nelson Algren, the novelist, once wrote that American literature, and by that he meant storytelling, is the woman in the courtroom who, finding herself undefended on a charge, asked, "Isn't anybody on my side?" That's the measure of the sway of narrative, its ability to find that woman, to hear her plaintive voice, to try to answer the question she's posed, isn't anybody on my side? This is, it perhaps goes without saying, not an easy world to navigate today. And let me state perhaps the obvious. These are unsettling, troubling times. We're at war in Iraq, and of course we're fearful at home. And amidst all this, it's not easy to be a social critic. It's not an easy time to tell stories that counter what we think we know. But I would suggest to you that this may be the most important time to be heard. This may be the most important time for people like ourselves to find our voice. For whether you believe that we ought to be in the Middle East, whether you believe that our mission there is right, or whether you believe it's misguided, what we can all agree upon is that the defense of our nation is paramount. And by that, I speak of the defense of our principles, of our values, of our liberties. And when I think of America, I find comfort and succor in its belief in justice and fairness and in equity. And yet I know from my time in our schools, from my time climbing the stairwells of public housing, from my time listening to our children, from my time talking to new immigrants, that we still need to fight for these things, for justice, for fairness, for equity. And so, in many ways, this may be the most important time for critics like ourselves to find our voice, to give voice to those whose lives don't measure up to the American ideal. It is, after all, what we want to so fiercely defend. It's a luxury not to have to worry whether you'll have three square meals a day or whether tomorrow you might be deported, separated from your livelihood and from your family. It's a luxury not to have to worry about being shot on the streets of your neighborhood or whether your school has any textbooks or art classes or a guidance counselor for college. It's a luxury not to have to worry whether you will have a roof over your head. This, of course, was all brought home in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Katrina, in my mind, pulled the curtain back. It revealed the deep and profound fissures in the American landscape. It exposed what many of us already knew, that many in this country, far too many, are left behind, both when it clouds over as well as when the sun's shining. We seem to be stunned that a place like New Orleans could house so many poor people, that so many had so little. All I could think to myself is, where has everyone been? What so unsettled me, and what should so unsettle all of us, is that so many Americans were surprised, even shocked, by what they saw. How can we not know? Such neglect, I believe, borders on the willful. We're a nation that too easily turns our collective head from that which discomforts. It's a luxury of apathy, of indifference, a luxury we cannot afford. This is the time to figure out what holds us together and what pushes us apart, to grasp the contradictions that mar the landscape, why and how it is that we can be both so proud and embarrassed by this country, how it is there can be such generosity beside such neglect. So what I want to do this evening is to ruminate on the importance of story, of personal narratives, in doing just that, trying to figure out what holds us together and pushes us apart. Or, as Nelson Algren suggests, why stories are so important in answering the plea of the woman in the courtroom, "Isn't anyone on my side?" You know, I've been thinking a lot about the place of narrative in recent years, especially in the context of the larger political stage. You know, you consider, for instance, the buildup to the Iraq war. The administration spun out a narrative that suggested, no, make that declared, that Saddam Hussein was a direct threat to our country, that he had developed and hidden weapons of mass destruction, that he was working hand in hand with Al-Qaeda. The American Congress, the American press, the American people let that narrative pass unchallenged. And as a result, we went to war with a country thousands of miles away, which in the end did not have weapons of mass destruction, did not have any relationship with Al-Qaeda, did not pose a threat to our country. The narrative we believed is a narrative that drove us. It's the narrative that guided us, or I should say, in the end, misguided us. It was, as we've come to realize, a false narrative. And so it's important in thinking about story that we recognize that story, if false, if twisted, if massaged, if anything less than honest and frank and square, can misdirect us, can push us into dark and inhumane corners, can spur us into dark and inhumane actions. A democracy dies without transparency. There can be no freedom, no justice, if we operate under false assumptions, if we aren't fully informed, if we aren't fully clued in. Truth is the engine of freedom. And the way to truth is by bearing witness, by telling stories, stories that are legitimate, that are authentic, that are honest, that are true to what has occurred. Now, I should take a second here just to tell you a little bit about myself and my relationship to story. You know, people ask me what I do for a living, and I tell them I'm an author, I'm a journalist, but the truth of the matter is I'm a storyteller. It's what I love to do most. It's probably the only thing I'm any good at. And in my case, I tell stories which are, to be unsexy about it, based in fact. Stories that are authentic, that are genuine, that are real. It's the never-to-be-chiseled dictum in my profession that what we write must be grounded in fact, verified by witnesses, by documents, or by our own eyes and ears. The other thing I should tell you about myself, if you don't already know, is that I tend to be drawn to stories of those along the margins. I tend to be drawn to stories outside of the center of the storm. Or perhaps more aptly, I tend to run from the storm's center. And part of it, I should be honest with you, is I don't fare particularly well under competition. It's why I don't work at a daily newspaper anymore. But on a more affirmative note, I relish journeying to out-of-the-way places, to spend time with people who otherwise might go unnoticed, to hear stories never before spoken, to simply hang out with what our own Studs Terkel calls the etceteras of the world. And so given that, I want to begin with a story. But unlike the narrative that behind our entry into Iraq, this is a very personal narrative. It's a story about Fanny Clonch, who was raised by her grandmother, first in Morocco and then in France. And when they were living in France, and Fanny was being raised by her grandmother, her parents had abandoned her. Her grandmother, Salima, would tell this story to Fanny over and over again at meals and before they went to bed. And the story went like this. When she was four, this is the grandmother, when she was four, she had been sold off into slavery in Morocco to a very wealthy family. And as she grew older into her teens, she became the family's cook. And she was determined to find her freedom. But when she came of age, she was married off. And fortunately, a year later, her husband died, which meant that suddenly she was free. Well, Fanny was never quite sure why her grandmother would tell her this story. When Fanny was 10, they were living in France at the time, her grandmother took Fanny back to Morocco for vacation. And while they were there, her grandmother, Fanny's grandmother, became ill and died. And Fanny knew no one. And so on her own, she sought out a friend of her grandmother's in Casablanca, figuring that that's where she could find refuge. And she went there and found this woman who had an older daughter, a grown daughter, and they took her in. And they took her in and they assigned her chores. They made her wash their clothes. They sent her out to buy groceries every day. They kept her out of school. Fanny was hoping that they would send her back to France, but that was not the case. And so what I'd like to play here is just a short tape of Fanny recounting this part of her story.
But that was not the case. The family did not care for me to have an education. They just wanted me to be there and do the tasks around the house. They truly thought that they were blessed to have this child who came to them, you know. They didn't have to invest anything to get this commodity. They didn't even have to buy a slave, you know. I came. They felt like they won the lottery. And Fatima, she was thinking about her own status as a woman in Morocco. Pretty soon I was this object that she could show to everybody. Once a week or every other week on a Sunday, we would go to the beach. They would go with the two little boys, and then they had this black little kid carrying the parasol. And for them, I was their signe extérieur de richesse, their symbol status. By showing me, they could tell that they had a certain wealth. At this point, I had been with the family for 4 or 5 months. I was just taking the time to figure out une échappatoire, a way out. It took a lot of time, and I was being very careful. As I was doing my chores, as I was going outside to do the groceries, I was also observing, and I got some money because I was able to pocket some money from going to the grocery store. I just pretended that instead of buying that spice that day, I didn't buy it and I pocketed the money. You could buy envelopes individually, and I bought one and I bought a stamp. And I grabbed a piece of paper from a notebook and I wrote the letter to the French embassy. it's not that extraordinary, even though I was 11. I was doing a lot of things like this for my grandmother. Every time that she needed a letter, I wrote it for her because she didn't know how to write. I wrote that my grandmother died and I've been stuck in Morocco. I'm with the Ghazali family and I would like to go back to France to my father. I did that when I was on an errand for the family. It was very calculated. No one was suspicious that I was gone. I went on a regular basis to the store, so I didn't even know that it was going to arrive there, but I just wrote Ambassade de France, Casablanca, Maroc, and that's it. A week later, two gentlemen from the embassy showed up. They came and I just ran out the door and grabbed one gentleman's hand and I didn't want to go back and I was pulling him down the stairs. the family was just in shock. They didn't say anything. 2 days later, I flew back to Paris. I was very happy, I was overjoyed, and it reminded me at that moment the story as it was told by my grandmother, that she was very happy to find her freedom. So it was like I finally got it and finally understood what she meant. I thought, this is it. I finally got to the place where my grandmother was, that I finally earned my freedom and that life was going to be much easier.
Great, thanks. There's more to Fanny's tale, which I'll come back to later, but I should give you a little backstory here. I met Fanny through my wife. Fanny teaches French now in the Chicago public schools, and my wife had known tidbits about Fanny's story, and so I'd called Fanny and asked her if she might want to tell it for a radio series that I was producing. And so she came down to the studios and she began to tell me and my producer about her grandmother, about ending up with her grandmother's friends, and she cried her way through it. You can hear some of it in this piece. But the first time she was sobbing, the tape was simply unusable. We had to ask her, in fact, to come back in a second time once she had calmed down. And so a couple of weeks later, she returned, and though she cried through much of the telling, she was in more control of her emotions. But knowing how difficult it had been for her, I asked her why she decided she was ready to talk about what had happened to her. And she told me that she wanted her children to know her story. She was doing this for them. She'd never told them about it, never. And yet it's so essential to who she is, to who she was, and who she became. She told me it was still too hard, even after the intervening 25 years, a quarter of a century. And so she held on to this secret. It's understandable. This period in her life just about destroyed her. It was humiliating, degrading, confusing. It still is. And when I think about how this 40-year-old woman kept this story inside her all these years, I think of others. Whether it be a child growing up on Chicago's West Side or a young girl raped in a Somalian refugee camp who made her way to America as a stowaway only to end up in detention, or a mother picked up at a chicken processing plant and separated from her children, how they pull inside themselves, how they can be utterly confused and disoriented, how they feel humiliated, how they come to look at the world through cynical and distrusting eyes, how their stories burn inside, and how such utter loneliness can eat away at one's soul. You know, there's the old William Faulkner line that the past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past. And that certainly is the case for those who have been marginalized because of race or class or ethnicity or politics or religion or circumstance. The past not only haunts them, but their past, at least making sense of it, and more importantly, getting others to acknowledge it, may well be their ticket to a reasonably good future. I remember when I first began spending time on Chicago's West Side some 20 years ago at the Henry Horner Homes. It was a neighborhood that was so distressed that a few years earlier, Mother Teresa had visited it, and she was so dispirited by what she saw that she sent sisters from her order to work in that community. And when I was there, what was so striking to me in that community was how this incredible silence that surrounded the people and the neighborhood. And there were two kinds of silences that I saw, one which for me was pretty self-evident, the other one which for me took a while to come to terms with. But the silence for me that was kind of obvious was the institutional silence surrounding the lives of the people in this community. And I always remember very early on when I was just beginning to report the book, I was hanging out at the Boys and Girls Club. It was really when I was trying to meet kids to write about. And I hadn't yet stumbled across Lafayette and Faro. And I was going there in the afternoons. And I'd come over there one afternoon. And the neighborhood was eerily quiet. And as I got there, people were just beginning to emerge from the high rises. And the kids were just beginning to emerge from the Boys and Girls Club. And I asked the adults in the neighborhood what had happened. And they told me that rival gangs had been shooting at each other from building to building, like naval ships at sea. And I had a hard time imagining that, and I went to the kids and asked them what was going on. They told me the same story. Well, being a good reporter, I went back to my office, and the next morning I called the police department and talked to the spokesperson and explained to them that I had been over in this neighborhood the day before and that there apparently had been this shooting between gangs from building to building, and I just wanted to confirm that, in fact, it happened. And she told me she'd get back to me, and an hour later she called me back and she told me that every morning the police superintendent had a meeting in which incidents like this are discussed. And she assured me that no such incident had been brought up at that morning's meeting and that so undoubtedly no such incident had happened. Well, I went back out to the neighborhood and I talked to the kids and I talked to their parents and heard the same story and in fact talked to the police officers in that community, and not only did they confirm the story, but they told me that they were so afraid that they had been targets of the shooting that they had taken cover under their squad cars. And it struck me that the police had crafted this narrative that all in this community was okay. And so it made it okay for them not to reach out, not to extend a hand. It permitted, it justified their abandonment of this community and of these people. But there's this other kind of silence for me, which has taken me a while to come to terms with. And it's in some ways a much more subtle kind of silence, a kind of self-imposed silence, not unlike the silence that I was talking about with Fanny, an unwillingness, if you will, for people to share their stories. And what I've come to realize over the years is that a lot of this unwillingness has to do with this fear that if they share their stories, they won't be believed. And I will tell you, I've been confronted with this time and time again. And I can remember shortly after There Are No Children Here came out, we were fortunate to have it made into a TV movie. It was Oprah's first TV movie. And when the screenwriter came out from New York, he was a playwright, I was to be his tour guide for 4 days to introduce him to the neighborhood and the people I'd written about. And he was a very quiet, soft-spoken, gentle man. And as we began to spend time together, I began to get this uneasy feeling that he didn't believe all that I'd written. So I took him to the worst of the high rises. I pointed out the biggest of the drug dealers and the meanest of the gang members. And on the fourth and last day, he and I and two friends of mine, two women who lived and worked at a neighboring housing complex, went out to lunch at Edna's, a restaurant on the west side. And as we were sitting in our booth, a young boy, maybe 13, 14 years of age, ran into the restaurant. And as he ran into the restaurant, he ducked behind the heating grill. And I looked outside, and there were a group of boys, and one of them was pulling a pistol out of a brown paper bag, and he started shooting. And needless to say, we were scared for our lives, and we ducked under the table. And I remember as we lay there, literally one on top of the other, all I could think to myself is, now he's going to believe me. And I mention this because I think this kind of self-imposed silence is the most painful and destructive kind of silence there is. And it is the kind of silence that will slowly sap the spirit out of an otherwise spirited people. And what it said to me was something very, very simple. We stop listening. We stop believing. And so people, when people ask me, where do we go from here, I tell them we need to start listening, to start believing. I mean, indeed, what could be more basic than speaking of our experiences and more basic than listening? You know, stories help us make sense of the world. They help us figure out our place in it. They help us make sense of our lives. They help us make sense of the nonsensical. Stories do two things. One is that they affirm our experiences. They give credence to our personal and collective histories. They make us feel less alone. The other thing that stories do is that they bring us places we otherwise might not visit. They introduce us to people we otherwise might not meet. You know, they open apertures into corners of the world that otherwise might remain dark and sequestered, out of sight, out of mind. It's my firm belief that people don't like to be pushed or pulled. They don't like to be yelled at or dismissed or pandered to. And therein lies the power of story, of narrative. It lets people find their own way. And there is, after all, far too much shouting going on, too much ranting, too much stay at home, here's what I think, I know what is best diatribes from people who have little curiosity for the lives of those at all different from their own. You know whom I speak of. But what really good stories do in the end is they create empathy. They place us in the shoes of others. They let us look at the world through the eyes of those whose lives may be very different than our own. They help a straight man understand what it's like to be gay, a black to understand what it's like to be a new immigrant, a Muslim to understand what it's like to be black, a rich man to understand what it is to be poor. They help us see what others see. They help us hear what others hear. It's the power, for instance, of John Hersey's Hiroshima, a book I'm sure all of you are familiar with. Here we are suddenly looking at an event from the inside out, from a perspective which no one else has offered. You know, think about it. When Hersey went off to report Hiroshima, there wasn't a single person who didn't know what had happened there. And yet no one had reported on that historic moment from the inside, from the shoes of our enemy. That book, to me, is an astonishing feat of empathy, and therein lies its power. I want to be clear when I talk about empathy that it's not confused with sympathy. Empathy is not about feeling sorry for others or taking pity on other people. It's all about identifying or understanding another's situation, their feelings, their motives. It's what Atticus Finch talks about in To Kill a Mockingbird, when at one point he tells Scout, if you can learn a simple trick, Scout, you'll get along a lot better with all kinds of folks. You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you crawl into his skin and walk around in it. That's what good storytelling is all about. You know, I never thought much about this notion of empathy, at least in any conscious way, until I began actually spending time in the Henry Horner homes with Lafayette and Farrow, the two boys I wrote about, and there are no children here. And I remember the first time that I really thought about this in any real way. I had taken Farrow, the younger of the two boys, to a movie, and I remember the movie because neither of us liked it very much. It was Field of Dreams. And we'd come home, it was maybe 9 or 10 o'clock at night. They lived on the first floor of a 7-story mid-rise. And we'd gotten home, and all the lights on the street and in the building were out, which was not unusual. And we pulled up, and I thought to myself, there's no way I'm going into that dark building, and I'll sit here and wait and make sure that Farrow gets in okay. And so I told Farrow to go on into the building, and then I realized that there was no way this 9-year-old boy was going into the building by himself. And so I began to understand what it must be like for those kids living in this community. In the end, I too had become hypervigilant. I was in this constant state of heightened state of arousal. At night, for instance, when I was sleeping, the slightest of sounds, the closing of a window, a conversation on the street, the slamming of a car door would wake me, would startle me. And so I began to imagine, or try to imagine, what it must be like for kids like Farrow and Lafayette. Empathy is the underpinning of narrative, and narrative is the underpinning of ensuring that life is fair and just, that people act decently and honorably, that the state embraces its citizens, all its citizens, and not abuses them or abandons them. Elie Wiesel once wrote of those like himself who survived the concentration camps, "They persist in surviving not only to survive, but to testify." In other words, they persist to tell their stories and the stories of their loved ones. They persist to share the past so that it might not be repeated, so that we see where we have failed and gain strength from where we have succeeded. I want to throw out some words of caution, though. Truth, as we well know, can often be elusive, but we especially have to be careful that we don't rewrite our narratives to conform to how we now view the world in the present. We have to be careful that the now doesn't distort the stories of then. And I think often of the story of Ibrahim Parlak, a story I know that many of you are familiar with. Ibrahim grew up as a Kurd in Turkey. And as you well know, the Turks have not been kind to the Kurds. For many years, they virtually denied their existence. In fact, they call them Mountain Turks. When Ibrahim was growing up in the 1970s and 1980s, the Kurdish language was forbidden for official use. Schools only taught in Turkish. Newspapers or television could not use the Kurdish language. Parents could not give their children Kurdish names. Kurdish songs and books were banned. Ibrahim tells a story of the time when he was a youngster that the military came through his village, and while his father threw books into a fire, Ibrahim and one of his brothers tried to salvage what they could, burying them in a nearby field. And when Ibrahim was in first grade, a classmate reported to the authorities that Ibrahim spoke Kurdish in his home. When he got to school, his teacher hit him with a wooden cane and then humiliated him by making him stand by the blackboard all day. It was not an easy time to be a Kurd in Turkey, especially for someone as independent-minded as Ibrahim. So he soon got involved in politics, and then after being arrested and released, he fled for Germany, where he became a leader of the political arm of the PKK, a Marxist-Leninist organization that was fighting for an independent Kurdish state. After 7 years in exile, Ibrahim decided he wanted to return to Turkey, and so with a few others, he tried to sneak over the border from Syria, and on the first attempt, they got into a firefight with some Turkish soldiers, and two soldiers were killed. Ibrahim eventually got into Turkey and then spent the next 6 months doing political work, hiding in the mountains, before he was captured by the Turkish police. He was brutally tortured, and then tried and convicted in a mass trial along with 57 others without an attorney. He was sentenced to death by hanging for his association with the PKK. Well, Ibrahim, in the end, gave up a munitions cache to the Turkish police, and in exchange, his sentence was reduced, and he was released after serving 16 months in prison. And as soon as he was released, he fled Turkey for the U.S. And here he applied for political asylum, which he received. This is back in 1991. And he settled not too far from here in southwest Michigan in the small town of Sawyer and opened a restaurant, Cafe Gulistan. And he and the restaurant became fixtures in this community. And he carved out a good life for himself. And then some 13 years later, in July of 2004, the FBI arrested Ibrahim. They charged him with being a terrorist. Now, it should be made clear that there were no allegations that Ibrahim was a threat to this country, that he had been involved in any illicit activity, or that he was involved with any militant groups. Instead, they argued that he'd been involved in terrorist activity in Turkey nearly 20 years earlier. Well, as legislators had come to reshape the definition of terrorism, first in 1991, then in 1996, and then again in 2001, Parlak's activities in Turkey took on a more sinister coloring. Since 9/11, terrorism, as we well know, has become a much less fluid term. And not unlike during the Cold War, when we saw the communist threat in anyone that opposed us, we see terrorism in any group that employs unconventional tactics of warfare. But most importantly, it's colored our view of history. It has shifted the way we look at the past. The PKK was not considered a terrorist organization until the mid-1990s, well after Ibrahim had entered this country and won political asylum. While Ibrahim currently faces a deportation order and is awaiting a decision on an appeal, but his is a cautionary tale. His is a narrative about the trickery of time. Sometimes the world changes on a dime, as it did on September 11th. And with the transformation of the present, the past too can suddenly take on a different hue. Narrative gets rewritten, not to get to any fundamental truth, but rather to fit the narrative of the present. Stories, if we're not careful, can, as it did in the weeks and months leading up to the Iraq War, be used to frighten and manipulate. Which is why it's not enough to just tell stories. They must be stories grounded in fact. They must be stories whose very reason for being is to get at the truth, or at least as close as we can get to it. They must be stories that are honest. There's another way, too, that stories, if twisted, or worse yet, if absent, can get in the way of acting decently and nobly towards others. And this brings me to the title of my talk, The House of Secrets. This has a very specific reference. Each year, 5,000 to 10,000 children, mostly adolescents, come into this country illegally. They come in by plane with smugglers or slip over the border through Mexico or Canada, or they come as stowaways on freighters, and they come here by themselves without an adult. As some of you know, my wife, Maria Walgen, this is her work. Trying to figure out in the end what's in the best interests of each of these children to stay here. What's in the best interest of these children to stay here or to find their way back with their families? And then to convince the immigration authorities of what would be best for that child. But in the meantime, these children are held in detention, and there's actually a shelter here in Chicago. And for me, it is a house of secrets. When I think of these children, I'm reminded of what I took away from my writing about the children in the inner city, and that's that self-imposed silence I spoke about earlier. You know, with the kids from our urban centers, it's this fear that they won't be believed. But with the children who come into this country by plane or over the borders or as stowaways without a parent, they hold on to their stories in part because they fear they won't be believed, but also because they've been instructed to distort or lie, or they fear that the truth might put them in graver danger, or they don't know why they were sent here, or it's too difficult to face the truth, that parents or others sent them away, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for not so good reasons. One boy I met at the shelter here in Chicago, a boy I'll call Ankit from India, he never disclosed his real story. Even after being in custody for nearly 2 years, he claimed that his parents had disappeared because of their political involvement. And it was a story he held on to, a story he told to adults who asked him. But eventually, when he was really pressed up against the wall and faced with the real story, which he still didn't fully know, it turns out that his parents still lived in his village. And when his story began to seep out, Ankit ran away. And we don't know where he is at the moment. He's somewhere out there without a parent, without an adult, without an advocate. He's completely and utterly alone, running from the authorities, and I suppose in no small measure, running from himself. Before he ran away, he said he most feared disappointing his father. But to this day, we don't know why he was sent here. Was it to satisfy some urge of his parents, or was it because his parents feared for his well-being, or some combination of those two? I suppose the easy thing to say would be that he was holding on to a secret, that all these kids that I talk about are holding on to secrets. But that assumes that they in fact know why they're here. You know, perhaps it's a former child soldier fleeing their country, or a teenage girl running from an abusive stepfather. Their challenge is to get others to believe their stories, to acknowledge their histories. But first, it's to make them comfortable and trusting so that they are willing to share their stories. Then there are kids like Ankit, for whom their story is not only a secret from us, but also a secret from them. Imagine not so much having a false narrative, but not having a narrative at all. That is the most utter kind of loneliness there is. And so a part of what we must try to do is to assist others in piecing together their stories. We must hear them. We must believe them. We must help them bear witness. In New York City, there's an organization called The Door, which offers refuge for children like Ankit. And I remember a counselor there a couple of years ago told me, I think sometimes they just need someone to witness what's happened to them. It's what Bob Kirshner knew and did so well, the power of bearing witness to the stories of those beaten down, those walked on, those without a voice. Bob knew the importance of trying to reclaim the past for those from whom it had been stolen. I often think of what happened in Rwanda when the Hutus set out to exterminate the Tutsi people. It was presented in the press as a result of a 100-year-old conflict, but as we know all too well now, it was genocide, pure and simple. And it took someone like Philip Gurevich in his brilliant book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families, to help set the record straight. And I always remember something that Philip had said in an interview, and it was this. We had been told that something unspeakable, something unthinkable, something unimaginable had taken place. I didn't like those words, unthinkable, unspeakable, unimaginable. I thought the very least we can do is think, speak, imagine what had taken place there. It's all about the power of story, of narrative. And this all brings me back to Fanny's story. It's an instructive one. When we left off, as you remember, the authorities had rescued her. And so they had sent her back, were about to send her back to France, where she could live with her stepmother and her family of 10 children. Fanny's father at the time was trying to open a new business in Africa. Well, that all seemed like the right thing.
So I am in this new household and I realize that the situation is a lot worse than it was in Morocco. A lot worse. They put me to work right away. The chores that I had to do were doubled or tripled, given the amount of people that lived in the house. I was taking care of everybody. I was happy that I was going to school, but I wasn't registered to eat lunch in the school, so I had to come home at lunchtime. And when I came home at lunchtime, I was not allowed to go back to school. I had to stay home and wash the dishes, mop the floors, make everybody's bed, take the trash outside, iron everybody's clothes. But I didn't cook. And I pretended that I didn't know how to cook. So whenever they asked me to boil water, I'll boil the water and I forget it and let it boil. I would put 3 or 4 times a lot of salt in a dish. I would burn stuff, and they would comment on how stupid I was, having a grandmother who was a cook and not knowing how to cook. I burned everything because I didn't want to be a slave like she was. I didn't want to end up like she was, but at the same time, my grandmother wanted something better for me. She had a better hope for me and great plans, and so I was thinking, she made it, and then so can I. So I wasn't gonna cook. The only plan I had was to go and meet with the judge who placed me with my father's mother-in-law. I had an idea where the judge was simply because the Palace of Justice was in Poitiers, and I knew that. So my goal was to travel to Poitiers, which is about 30 kilometers from Châtellerault. At this point, I was 13. The day that I planned to run away was a Friday right before Easter break. I came home and spent some time washing dishes, as I usually did. And after dinner, I cleaned more dishes, and I decided to take the trash to the basement. And before doing so, I just grabbed my jacket and I threw it from the window so that nobody would be suspicious. And I took the trash down, and then I just left it there and grabbed my jacket and I ran. To make a long story short, the judge investigated and ordered that I would be removed from the family permanently and made recommendation that I'd be sent to a boarding school in Lusignan. For the first time, I felt strong and knew that I was going to make it.
Fanny's grandmother's story saved her. It's what inspired her, it motivated her, and to this day, Fanny keeps a small black and white photo of her grandmother by her bedside. She wants her grandmother to know she made it, and as Fanny told me at one point, my grandmother told me that story because she definitely didn't want it to happen to me. And it's why Fanny eventually chose to tell her story, so her children could hear it, so it wouldn't happen to them. She wanted to tell her story so that others might learn, so that others might know, so that others might find their way. In the end, that's the power of story. That once you know it, once you unravel it, once you can make sense of it, then and only then can you move forward. Only then can you make sense of the past, can you write the present, and find succor and comfort in what lies ahead. Thank you. Anybody? Boy, a bashful crowd. There you go.
So what about fiction and the truths of fiction?
Right. You know, it's funny, I was standing here thinking to myself, kind of knocking myself across the head, especially after being introduced by Sarah, that at one point I mentioned, story needs to be grounded in fact. And yet, I think I'm wrongheaded about that, to be honest with you. I think what stories need to do is that they need to be honest. They need to be square. They need to make some effort at trying to get at the truth. And I think, to be honest with you, that, you know, it's interesting when I think about literary nonfiction or creative nonfiction or new journalism, whatever you want to call it, you know, it really sort of saw its heyday in the 1960s. And Tom Wolfe was one of the originators of it, or at least one of the practitioners. And he made the argument back then that fiction wasn't doing its job, that fiction wasn't adequately addressing the issues of the day. And so nonfiction writers had to take it on using all the tools and the craft of novelists. I would argue that in some ways that's kind of switched, that in fact today I think that it's some of our fiction writers, especially some of our new immigrants who I think have a much cleaner perspective on this country, are we seeing some of the most truthful and honest and searing stories. So I'm glad you asked that, because I was sitting here thinking to myself, I can't believe I said that. So,
I was wondering, when you're working with people and telling their stories, and maybe in some mediums more than others, like radio or something, and it comes to editing, is there times when they would edit it differently than you would, and how have you thought about that, or How's that come?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, because clearly, you know, given what I do, I'm a kind of intermediary. And so I take people's stories and, one, I try to help them interpret it, and then I try to interpret it for others. And so unquestionably, my voice gets mixed up with theirs. And even in a radio piece like this, which is clearly in Fanny's voice, I mean, Fanny sat with us for many hours, and we had to edit that down to 10 minutes, and those were decisions that I and my co-producer made. And I think in the end, that what you try to do is try to be as honest as you can to your subjects. And I think one of the things that I've learned over the years is that people are complicated. And so it's I think, important, it's essential that we find a way to be honest about the people we're writing about, or in the case of radio, that we're doing pieces about. The other thing is, I also think that people are pretty savvy, and people know when they're not being dealt a straight hand, when somebody's pulling their punches. And so certainly there have been times when I've written about somebody or done a radio piece about somebody when they've been dissatisfied by what I've done. And sometimes it's things that you wouldn't expect. But I think for the most part, if you're honest with what you see and what you hear, that I think in the end you'll be honest to people's stories. The other thing I should tell you, that it's also, it's become clear to me that I sometimes feel like a bit of a therapist, because, you know, I spend time with people, and often they don't have a good sense of their own narrative. And so in the process of talking with me and my relentless questions, as my wife will tell you, is that people begin to make sense of their own stories. And so it becomes this kind of process where people discover things about themselves as we're talking.
I actually like to ask you about, like, say, in reference to earlier when you're talking about Fanny's story and she broke down. So, you know, clearly in this case you're an interviewer, and how do you kind of, like, say, relate? You know, how do you show empathy? How does one demonstrate, you know, a sense of empathy with the, you know, the person you're talking to?
Right.
And, you know, how does that also impact you? What are you going to do about that particular part of the interview? You know, that right. Those sets of emotions, how do they affect you in the long term as well?
Right, right. Well, I think, you know, that, given what I do, I'm a journalist by training. You know, we're sort of taught to be detached and distant, but anybody who's being at all honest with you, there's no way you can go out into the world, engage with people, and be detached and distant, and especially given what I do, spending weeks, months, sometimes years with people, you become very close to them, and so it's hard not to become very engaged with people's lives. And, you know, all you can do is what you would do with anybody, I think, who runs into a difficult moment. I mean, Fanny was sobbing. It wasn't that she was going to collapse there or that she wanted to run away. It just became extraordinarily difficult. And all I could do at that moment was to listen. I mean, I think the hard thing for her was that I had to listen, and then I had to have her come back in again and do it all over for us, because it really wasn't usable. And I also wanted to do her justice. It wouldn't have done, even if you could have made sense of her through her tears, it wouldn't have been fair to her and her story. And so she needed to go through that the first time, and then come back in a second time, and I think be able to tell the story in a much more cohesive and calmer way.
I guess mine is a question of audience, because I think, and I don't want to make assumptions, but I feel like people came to this lecture because we're probably all in some sense listeners, right? And there's so many stories, and I guess just how to make people listen and how to not, you know, like, how do you find audience in people who are already, you know, feeling empathetic and to listen to all the stories and reach out to audiences who aren't empathetic?
Right. Well, I think it's a really good question, but I should tell you, when I'm writing or when I'm doing radio, my audience is not you guys. I mean, I hope I reach you, but it's really people, as you suggest, who otherwise wouldn't pay any attention to kids growing up in the projects or kids being detained or somebody like Fanny. And for me, that's the power of story. I am absolutely convinced, and maybe I'm a little naive about this, but if you find a good story, people love a good story. It's only natural instinct to sit there and want to know what happens next. I mean, I go to my 10-year-old son, we go to the movies, And he drives me crazy because he sits there and goes, Dad, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And I just have to calm him down and just tell him to be patient. But that's, I think, how we all respond to a good story. And that's why I think stories are so powerful. They don't judge, they don't push, they don't pull. They allow people, they allow readers to find their own way. And I will tell you, I go back to this, I do think there is just far too much shouting in this world. And as wonderful and as democratic as the internet is, I don't think it has served us well in that regard.
So my question kind of echoes the earlier one, but it's addressing the other side of the coin. You said the story that you pursue are those of the forgotten, the neglected, and yet the media, and I'm speaking as a working journalist, is obsessed with the obvious, the famous. So I wonder what strategies have you been using in getting the stories out?
Right. You mean, in other words, what strategies have I used to convince editors to write them?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. I've dealt with a lot of them.
Yeah. Again, and I worked at the Wall Street Journal, which is a paper that, you know, has made its name covering the rich and the powerful and done a terrific job of it. And let me say that I think that that's terribly important. I mean, one of the things that I didn't talk about in this talk, but one of the things that has me most distressed is the state of my profession. It has me very worried. I don't know how we can have a democracy, a rigorous democracy, without a rigorous independent press. And I think it is being threatened now. Whatever you can say about how the media has responded the past 5 or 6 years, I think we have to be very concerned about the future, especially of our newspapers. But having said that, so I've worked at places like the Wall Street Journal, and again, I think any editor worth their salt loves a good story. And so for me, the challenge has always been, okay, I want to write about inner city kids. And so my editor says to me, well, we know all there is to know about inner city kids. Been reading about them for 15, 20 years. And I say to them, well, I want to tell you the story about Lafayette and Farrell, these two boys, and here's the story that I want to tell you. And so I think it's so much about finding the story, about finding the small story, because the smaller the story, in some ways, the more powerful it is, and the farther, the greater reach it has.
Well, I want to thank you for your stories. I mean, I think that what you're doing is profound and amazing. Like Dr. Kirshner, you're humanizing the folks that were dehumanized through torture and other means. And as someone who was close to Dr. Kirshner in terms of his work with, he did work around Palestinian torture prisoners, was something very important to us that those stories came out. And now I work with young people in Southwest Chicago. And in the past 6 months, the stories of the violence and the shootings and the deaths and the killings that have been taking place, these stories really aren't coming out. And there's a dehumanization that has taken place, I feel, where people are looking at and marching against the criminals. But who are the criminals? Are they the children? Are they the kids that are in these groups? Or really, they're the stories of poverty in our neighborhoods. And I'd like to ask you if maybe in the future you could join us in helping us to lift up these stories, because I think if we lift up these stories, we'll create an incentive for more to stand with these children and these youth so that we can change the policies that create that economic disparity.
Well, thanks. I'm here. I think we need to do. I mean, for me, one of the paradoxes about this country is, you know, we like to think of ourselves as this part of this greater community, that we're all in this together. And yet, for me, what's so striking about this country is, in the end, how disconnected we are from each other. And you certainly see that with the violence. You know, you think about the shootings in Chicago. Last year, there were some 2,700 shootings in the city. 85% of them were in half the police districts. And so it makes it easy, I think, for the rest of us to turn our heads away from what's taking place there.
I'm wondering, given all the time you spent in the Henry Horner homes with Lafayette, Farrell, and others, what your impressions are, what stories you're hearing, if you will, from the sort of Chicago public housing diaspora in the south suburbs and west suburbs and other parts of the city,
right.
How you see that and what's happening right. with that.
Right. I mean, this is, of course, is the transformation plan of public housing. And let me back up. I don't think there's anybody who spent any time in public housing in the city who would argue that those things shouldn't have come down a long time ago. And the question, of course, is if they do come down, what do we do to replace them? What do we do about all the people living there? When I was spending time in public housing some 20 years ago, there were an estimated 200,000 people living in the city's public housing. It was a city the size of Des Moines, Iowa. And we've done the easy part, which is to tear down the high rises. And people have been scattered to the winds, to the south suburbs, to equally troubled communities like Englewood and Garfield Park, to places like Aurora and Rockford and Elgin. And I used to say somewhat glibly that, that out of sight, out of mind about public housing. But as I now think about it, you couldn't drive into the city from the west or south side and not see these monoliths hovering by the expressways, and they're gone. And so I do think there's this kind of notion in places like Chicago that squalor is somehow going out of fashion, and nothing could be further from the truth. And my fear is that what's happening in Chicago and is what's happening elsewhere in this country is that we're replicating what's happened in Western Europe, where the very poor, in their cases, new immigrants, will ring the city like a wreath, and that the center of our cities will thrive, and that as you get farther and farther out, you'll find that's where our poverty is, really out of sight, out of mind.
I thank you for being an advocate of individuals' stories. But as a scientist, I think I would be better served if at some venue it could be presented both sides. How did this situation evolve gets presented at the same time as the individual situation? It would make much more sense to me, not being a social scientist.
Right. Well, I think context is incredibly important, and I think that sort of an understanding when you tell these small stories, I think you're absolutely right, that understanding the context, the historical, the economic, the social, the political context is absolutely essential. You can't write about kids growing up in public housing if you don't understand the history of race and poverty in this country, the history of public housing, the history of police, and so that has to be a part of that story. Well, thank you very much.
I'm John Schumann, and I'm co-chair of the Faculty Advisory Board for the Human Rights Program, and I really want to thank Alex Kotlowitz for doing a beautiful job of honoring Bob Kirshner's legacy with both your own narrative, but also the compelling narratives that you wove through your story. It was quite extraordinary. I'm here to wrap things up. I just wanted to comment that the Human Rights Program is now celebrating its 10th anniversary, and the Human Rights Program is an integral, very small, but yet important part of the legacy of Dr. Robert Kirshner. And we're so delighted that you could share this event with us, the many alumni that are here, the community at large, the students, and the Kirshner family and friends. The Human Rights Program is a beacon, both here on campus for many different students from all schools of the university, as well as being a beacon to other colleges and universities. It's one of our chief functions. And I would hasten to say that one of the functions of the Human Rights Program is helping students learn their very own narrative skills, both bringing out their narratives and those of the dispossessed. So your remarks were right on point. I just want to take the opportunity to thank, I've thanked Alex, I want to thank Susan Zesch for her directorship of the Human Rights Program, now in her seventh year. She has largely realized the vision of Bob Kirshner and has done a fabulous job, so she is to be thanked. In addition, I I would just like to extend the board's thanks to the staff and the tremendous hours and the tremendous behind-the-scenes efforts that were put in to efforts like tonight's and the many programming opportunities around the campus that you see. In addition, thank our students, our alumni, our donors, and you, our community. I will end with just a couple of announcements. Number one, if you have not had the opportunity, please check look at the Human Rights Program's website at humanrights.uchicago.edu. A shameless plug. Earlier tonight, somebody left a pair of glasses in the Tillin room we were in having an earlier reception, and those glasses are right on this table with a yellow tablecloth to my left. Alex Kotlowitz will stay with us and be outside in the hall opposite the book table. You can purchase, I think, a selection of his books, and he's going to stay and sign. And with that, I invite you to stay for the reception because there's now a whole lot of food. There is some food here in the back. So thank you very much.